It's time for the Outspoken Cyclist, your weekly conversation about bicycles, cyclists, trails, travel, advocacy, the bike industry, and much, much more. You can subscribe to our weekly podcast at OutspokenCyclist.com or through your favorite podcatching app to listen anytime. Now here's your host, Diane Jenks.
Hello, welcome to the Outspoken Cyclist. I'm your host, Diane Jenks. Thanks for tuning in today. EOS, end of summer. What a strange summer it's been, especially when we look at what Mother Nature has thrown at us all summer long. But we still want to feel a sense of normalcy, and so today I'm welcoming two guests to the show. First up is a name that is synonymous with bicycles. I would venture to say that no one who listens to this podcast doesn't know the name or hasn't had a bicycle with that name on the down tube at some point in his or her life. And after a lifetime of living and breathing bicycles, Richard Schwinn has decided it's time to retire. And at the end of June, his Waterford Precision Bicycles stopped taking new orders and prepared to close. He did that the following month. So I made him promise to speak with me as soon as he and his wife returned from a well-deserved vacation, and today he fulfills that promise. Then I'm speaking with Sergio Bravo, the producer of the Master Bike Builders show that will take place September 16th and 17th in Bentonville, Arkansas. As Bentonville continues to develop as a favorite destination for cyclists, Sergio is bringing a custom bike builder show to highlight artisans and their work in a beautiful outdoor setting. So let's begin my conversation with Richard Schwinn. Richard and I have been friends and business colleagues for decades. I'm always interested in what he has to say and how he thinks about things. And today, he shares his thoughts about his decision to retire and close Waterford, who, if anyone might fill that gap in what was a unique place in the custom bicycle business, and what the future might look like, including his ideas on e-bikes and what he calls electronification. Hello, Richard. Welcome back to the show. I'm really happy to see you and speak with you today. Not everybody's going to be able to see you, but I can. So how are you? Are you well?
Great. And I'm glad to be here. Always a pleasure to chat with you. Yes, I'm doing quite well right now.
It's been a long time since you and I actually sat down and had a chat. I can remember an occasion at a show where we actually at that moment came up with the whole idea of the Gunner line. I mean, the idea was already there, but that's the day you named it. We were together at a Mexican restaurant. I don't even know where the hell we were.
We were there with Chris Dimmick. Remember Chris?
I do.
And Chris is still working with Lee Katz at Lake Shoes. I just found that out the other day. So, yes, the world sometimes changes and sometimes it goes back. I sort of look at the bike business as being like the industry California. You can check out anytime you like, but you can never leave. And I think the same may actually apply to Lee Katz.
You know what? I agree with you. I think it's been a couple of years since I had him on the show, but I was thinking back to, you know, the original Lake Shoes and the whole Lee Katz thing. So I guess we should actually start with the small pachyderm in the room. It was a shock. I actually got a message from the editor of Bicycle Retailer who said to me, "Is Waterford closing?" I'm like, my jaw dropped to the floor. And you did decide to retire. More power to you, by the way, and close Waterford Precision. So let's start with what precipitated the decision now.
Well, the big thing was that three of us finally hit retirement age. And I'm going to say four of us because the fourth is my wife, but our chief painter and our office manager. And myself, I hit 69 years old. And so I was counting the time that I'm still here on this planet. And I'm going, yeah, I mean, I enjoy the bike business, but there are a lot of other things I'd also like to enjoy. So this is maybe a good time to make the move. The other thing that's good is that this is the best possible time to for the people who weren't about to retire to go and look for jobs. The economy is really healthy. The people who are not retiring all have amazing skills and abilities that will be sucked up in the employment world. And I will say they're all going to get raises because the pipe business doesn't pay that well. We always try to be as generous as we could be with our employees, but I just think the industry and the nature of it makes it really hard compared with the rest of the economy. So people were, I won't say they were enthusiastic to leave, except for our office manager. She definitely wanted to get out of there. But everybody else really worked amazingly hard and amazingly effectively during a period where they know the business is closing. And we shipped out an astounding number of bikes in the last 30 days. And they all turned out really quite good. In the custom bike business, there's always complications, and that's just part of the world there. And I think everyone really did a yeoman's job to make every bike, every one of our last bikes count and become treasures. And we literally have created a new collectible, which is Waterford bikes and gunners. So
that's true. That is true. So I know when I spoke with you, and I did speak with you that same day, you said you had a list in front of you of your top dealers and you were going to be placing those calls. What was the initial reaction as you began to talk with these dealers? I mean, it came out of the blue for me. So I don't know if anybody had an inkling or if you just said, we're keeping this under our hat until the time.
Well, they didn't have a clue. And I'm not sure what ended up actually really precipitating things that the bike retailer found out about it. I think it was that we started talking to our customers. One of our customers was Georgina Terry, and I didn't totally swear her to secrecy. And, you know, she was buying a lot of bikes from us and a wonderful person to work with. Unfortunately, she needed to find a replacement supplier. And so as she snooped around, that opened the doors, the floodgates. And I certainly understand her need for doing it. In fact, it remains a gap. There's what we have done is not something that other people have been able to fill in. And so it remains to be seen how that is all going to turn out.
Well, that was going to be one of my questions. You sort of have filled in the edges of it. Maybe we can get into the meat of that in a few minutes. Let me remind our listeners, we're speaking with Richard Schwinn, Waterford Precision Bicycles, Gunner, Paramount. The name is iconic in our business. And I think to about 98% of the American public, that name is synonymous with bicycles. And, you know, I can't say I'm happy to see Waterford not be there, but I am happy that you and Shu get to retire. I think that's really awesome. So are there still loose ends that you're working out right now? You alluded to the fact you do have some stuff left. I know that the building got sold and most of the equipment is probably gone. What's left?
Well, not much. We tried to get things as clean as we could. And about all that's left are decals. And we actually sold off the touch-up paint to somebody we are working with to supply touch-up. And it turns out that even though we've gone to a lot of standard PPG colors, that there's no supplier for touch-up paint. The only supplier, not only for the bike world, but technically, we'd be the only supplier to anybody who might want to get that for other uses of those colors. So those are loose ends that we want to put together. There's always little things that have to happen, you know, people managing unemployment claims and things like that, the administration of the business. But in general, it's pretty well buttoned up. There's nothing left of the factory. It's been sold off. The equipment is gone. We were still shipping bikes as the locusts were descending to remove equipment.
At least they were done and in boxes, though, right?
We were still boxing.
Oh, my goodness.
And we did have a way to finally staple the last boxes. I think the last one or two boxes actually had to be taped shut because we had no compressor. It had been sold.
Do you remember Bob McKee?
No.
All right. He was the Bianchi rep. And he used to come into my store and say, look around at the inventory. He goes, you know, the only good bike is a sold bike. So we can apply that to everything, right?
We didn't realize how thorough the locusts would be. So they literally walked out the door with our accounts payable because we hadn't emptied the accounts payable files. And so fortunately, they were sold to somebody in Racine. And I said, do you really want to be the person who ran off with the bills? You're certainly welcome to pay them. They go, no. So I went down and like boxed them up and brought them back. So liquidations like this are not something that that anyone likes to go through a lot. I'm now more experienced in what to do, although I'm looking forward to there never being a next time.
I'll bet you are. So let me ask another question that didn't occur to me till now, and that is warranty. Is there going to be an issue with warranty? Has somebody agreed to look at bikes if there are problems? Although, of course, you know, when they go out the door, I mean, when we got our bikes, I guess it's past tense now, you know, that was never an issue. And if there was ever an issue, you took care of it right away. So what about that?
We don't have any way of supplying warranties. That's the bad news. The good news is, and it's a lifeline warranty, the other lifetime is a lifetime of the business. Now, it may be there are still people who are nosing around with the brand name.
Interesting.
And who have some interest in it. And I think they didn't necessarily want to take in all the baggage of the factory as it is. And sometimes it's better to start from scratch. And they may be interested in it and they may establish some warranty policy. That's one of the reasons I was really glad that we have been free of calls for, oh, I've got this problem with your frame. Now, I did actually have a couple of calls going, well, where is this thing? Where is that? And we were able to clean them up. So the team did a remarkable job of achieving an astounding level of quality on that count. You know, we don't really have a whole lot of other claims. We've been very generous about some of the claims that we've had. If people were assuming that that would be out there, they probably won't be. That's one of the downsides and one of the things that I don't like about closing, but I don't have a way to deal with it.
I hear you. It's not a huge problem because when Waterford was up and running, you would handle all of that. So people not understanding that it's not any longer there, I think that's a good reason. Whereas people who were still open often didn't handle warranty. So I think that you have a better handle on that. Let's take a short break. And when we come back, I want to talk about the future of steel. I want to talk about the place that sort of opened up because you aren't there. And I want to talk about what you see about e-bikes and a couple other things. You're listening to The Outspoken Cyclist. We'll be right back. We are back on The Outspoken Cyclist. If you're just joining me, I'm speaking with Richard Schwinn. And if you didn't know it, you know it now. Waterford Precision Cycles closed at the end of June. They stopped taking orders at the end of June. It's left a huge, in my opinion, and maybe not. I mean, Brian and I have this conversation all the time. I think it's left a huge hole in the market for this company that isn't a custom frame builder like a Richard Sachs or a Dave Wages or a Chris Kelly, but also isn't a Trekker specialized. You know, you were able to produce bikes for people like Georgina. I think All City you produced for a while, Standard you produced for a while, you produced bikes for Rivendell. And then, of course, you produce bikes for people like Brian at our shop so that we could actually have a margin to buy a frame and then sell it to somebody who comes in. Also, you were a custom shop.
which is very different from everybody else, meaning we could send you a design, you would build to our design, and then ship us a frame. Very unique, very important to us. And I've spoken with a couple of other dealers who were kind of crying and in their beer about the whole thing. What about that market? Is it going away? Is it necessary that somebody fill it? What do you see the future of steel?
Well, the future of steel is different than the future of American bike supply. Steel remains a terrific material for bikes, and it's a more sophisticated material. It makes a lot more sense in terms of achieving a great ride quality, and there is going to be a continuing following for steel bikes for a long time. The issue of our company is that we were able to produce in relatively decent volumes. We could do OE business. And that is something that hasn't been replaced. The name Breadwinner has come up a couple of times as a company that has been attempting to get into that market, but I don't know how far they've gotten. I know of them, but I don't know them. But there isn't anybody who's building at that level. It's Cerati used to build at that level and did some OE work. Most of it was their own brand, but they built a bunch of bikes for Paramount. And so they had that capability and that level of volume. The obstacle for success in that area is not steel. It is actually parts supply. And that is a huge problem. That is another factor in our getting away from the business. When we started out in business, and you'll recall this, there was a supplier named Security Bicycle. And we could sell you a frame, and we call up Security, and they go, Diane needs a kit. And now there was a complete bike. And this was actually a notion that pioneered in the Schwinn world and Paramounts. One of Schwinn's distribution centers had component kit packages with wheels and everything else. So the Paramount factory, the Waterford Paramount factory, could ship a bike to a dealer. The dealer would call up and order a kit. Now they've got a complete bike. And what was nice about that for the dealer was this was the prize bike that they could reward their best mechanics. So if you were a good mechanic, you got to build a Waterford. That was a mark that you were really a good pro mechanic. That worked great through the 2000s. And then we started to see a shift. One is that Shimano, for whatever reasons, decided that they wanted to move away from allowing kits. And so the first thing they did is they cut off Security Bicycle. Then Quality Bike Parts, you know, looked like they were taking up the slack. They had wheel building, they had kits, they had everything. And then Shimano came in and said, we're not interested in having Quality be that supplier. Eventually, Shimano created its own domestic sources of supply, and their goal has been to be the complete bike supplier, but with only their branded merchandise.
Right.
I don't want to speak ill of their branded merchandise. I'm sure it's reasonable, but it also makes these bikes really generic. There's no customization involved. There's no flavor. And if there's anything new, then, you know, it's hard for them to deal with it. And they also have not been all that reliable supplier, because their biggest priority are the big factories and the big brands. They need to keep Trek and Specialized happy. They need to keep their Asian factories equipped and supplied. And that is their mantra. In the old days, custom builders like us had a direct line to Shimano, and we could say, look, here is a trend that is moving forward. Maybe you need to be thinking about equipment that meets those trends. And as we passed into the new millennium, the 2000s, we found their ears to become increasingly deaf. What they eventually said is, look, we listen to the people who are big customers. If you are not a big customer, we really don't want to listen to you because that's not going to generate orders for us. It's not efficient enough for us. And we're going, boy, there's some real unmet needs that your big suppliers don't know about yet because we're 5 years ahead of that market.
That's true. Very interesting.
And they go, we don't care because you're not buying enough to be worthwhile. And that's what Shimano came along with. SRAM has been a little bit better. You know, Campy follows Shimano. They're not really listening too much to us. And Shimano sometimes just led us down a bad path. And that actually happened with gravel bikes. What they decided to do was take their very successful Dura-Ace and Ultegra kits and narrow the cranks. You know, we threw up our hands because we're going, wait a minute here. Everybody's looking for bigger tires. And you've now made it impossible for us to satisfy the customer with tires that are fat enough for their needs. And their answer was, but that's not what the big guys are asking for. But this is what the customer is going to want that big brand is going to care about. And then finally they lumber along, and 3 years ago, 4 years ago, they introduced the GRX group. And that is finally wide enough to support a big tire. The next battleground is going to be on gearing. You know, when you and I were in business, you could order a triple chain ring bike.
Yes, you could. Although nobody liked front derailleurs, but they did work, sort of.
They did work. And the people who are of a certain age, I'm going to say I'm now one of them, really appreciates low gears and yet doesn't want to give up high gears.
Right.
And so it's been a nonstop battle over the past 20 years to try to encourage the component suppliers to provide good quality, wide range gearing. Now we're seeing cassettes that have real wide ranges, but they only work with a one by.
Right.
I want to have a two by. Well, the two by, you know, we have these constraints here on gear capacity in the front derailleur. So you're kind of that, you know, it's really better than any of the double systems that we've had in the past. I'm going, but it's still not wide enough for the people who are really most able to buy them and actually pay you without being sponsored.
Let me ask you another question about people like Jan Hein, who has come up with his Compass line. Is that what it is? René Urs?
Compass. He's got several brands he's been building.
And he's got a crank that Brian is using for some of these things. But you also have an issue with everything going toward electronic and obsolescence. So when we were, and of course, this really dates us, 6-speed, 7-speed, 8-speed, it's pretty much interchangeable. Then you got to 9-speed, which is 10-speed. But now you've got 12-speed, and they're just saying, well, we don't care about your old 10-speed bikes. We have bikes out there that were sold as lifetime bikes that nothing is available to upgrade them as the componentry wears out.
Correct. And that is becoming a niche that people like Rivendell and people like Jan Hein are going to fill. I don't know what they're going to do for electronic stuff. I mean, Shimano introduced their 12-speed and moved it downscale and said, we're just going to stop doing cables.
Right.
Everything's going to be electric. Now, they've had to change their tune. Because if you have a bike that's built for cables, you know, electronification may be a big problem. In fact, one of the big battlegrounds that we were looking at, especially for larger scale models like the Gunners and like some of our private label bikes, is just the explosion of different cable routings.
There's the can of worms right there.
There is a can of worms where all the cables you've got the electronic shifting, you've got the wireless shifting, you've got any number of things, any number of possibilities. That is one of the battlegrounds that a lot of people are going to deal with. But again, the big players in the market are indifferent. they're not thinking of lifetime bikes. They're not thinking of long-term ownership. That is going to be an increasing problem for people who are building bikes as investments rather than as simply consumables.
As in disposable consumables. And that's the other thing I want to get to. Let me take another moment to reintroduce you. We're speaking with Richard Schwinn about some of the real problems that bike shops or custom builders who may or may not be in the Trekker specialized world are facing. One is, of course, component problems, which we had this enormous backlog during the pandemic. Once that broke loose, all of a sudden, everybody had more inventory than they knew what to do with. And that's still a problem today. But Shimano can come up with being out of stock on things that are essential, and you're sitting on a bike, so that's always been a problem. But I want to know about the environmental impact of carbon, 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 carbon. There is nothing you can do with a carbon bike. And as soon as you lay it down, you either need to send it to Craig Calfee to have it fixed, or you're throwing it away.
Well, you probably know more about that. Every bike has its recycling issues. I mean, I suppose you can recycle a steel frame. You can hand it off to somebody. You've got aluminum components. I'm sure that there's a way to deal with carbon fiber the same way as they have to deal with tires. I mean, it's the same problem. You just got a pile of carbon. So one of the issues in Europe is the idea that they want to create an entire cycle of materials movement, where when you design a product that you are also thinking about its recycling and reuse. And that philosophy, of course, is ignored in this country, but Europe is a big enough market for bikes that ultimately I believe they're going to find a solution to that. And the Euros are very cognizant of the environmental impacts of their world.
So let's take another short break, and we'll be back to speak with Richard some more. You're listening to The Outspoken Cyclist. We are back on The Outspoken Cyclist. I'm your host, Diane Jenks, and we're speaking with Richard Schwinn about a whole host of interesting topics.
The next topic, which is going to be close to one of our last topics, is e-bikes. There's the problem of the exploding batteries, the one terrible incident in New York that killed four people in an apartment above a bike shop where I guess the batteries were being charged, and that didn't work out so well. Mm-hmm. So, but yet e-bikes they're here to stay. I can remember Ed Benjamin 40 years ago talking about them. And yep. Now here we are. What do you think? Where is it going? And what are going to be some of the obstacles to getting e-bikes into people's hands at the level we're talking about? Not just the mail order, this or a Trek that, but something high quality and lightweight and fun.
Well, e-bikes are an entire family of products that are parallel to bikes, and they replace them, but there's so many different dimensions. So I'll speak to maybe what might be appropriate at the upper end. There are some interesting products out there. The work that Porsche is doing is most attractive, because what their philosophy is that a bike rider still wants to pedal their bike, and that the electronic component is something that leverages them to be able to do some things for parts of a ride, but they're going to be riding most of the time. So the problem with an e-bike, as it is typically marketed, is it is sold based on speed and distance. And the bicycle industry is addicted to the notion that more is better all the time.
Yes.
Now, of course, Gunner's first principle, first theorem, is more is better only about half the time. And you have to pick that half. So there is a fuzzy line, and they're crossing a line into a class of vehicle that is really more like a moped or a small motorcycle than it is a bicycle. And the problems have to do with our legion. I mean, how well do you fit in traffic? If you've got a bicycle that can go 30 miles an hour, then they can travel most roads at the speed of cars. The question is, how are they regulated versus the regulation for motorcycles or mopeds or those other devices that they're infringing on? Right now, it's the Wild West. There's not much regulation at all. That's one of the reasons we have these battery issues. The motorcycle people are also wrestling with these battery issues, and the stakes are something that they're used to dealing with. Bicycle people are used to the Wild West that we have in the bicycle world, and now the manufacturers have to address this. One of the reasons that we didn't want to get farther into the e-bike business is that we would need to have an engineering department. It's not like you can have a bike designer like Mark Muller and then deal with e-bikes. Even though there are e-bike kits out there,
right?
We would have to vet the kits.
Of course.
The second problem with e-bikes is that by the time you give them a competitive travel distance and a competitive speed, you now have a much heavier bicycle than is comfortable to pedal. So what happens is, if it's really flat or if you're going downhill, you might not need electric power. But if you're just riding along, you're going to have to work. It's actually going to be pretty hard work. It's not the fun of riding a lightweight bike. And I'm not a weight obsessive person, but I know the difference between riding a 22-pound bike and a 42-pound bike. And it's a lot of work. On the high end, the people like Porsche are designing very lightweight systems that are really assist. They're like, I'm going to turn it on to get up this hill. And that's kind of nice. But once I'm at the top of the hill and I'm riding along, I don't need any battery power, and it's not causing me to do a lot more work. And that system can't weigh more than about 8 pounds. We will feel 8 pounds. It takes 12 pounds to affect the speed of a bike by 1 mile per hour. In the old days, that was really an astounding amount. So people were counting grams, you know, you're sitting there going, what are you giving up? You have to live with an uncomfortable saddle. I assure you, you're going to be way less efficient with an uncomfortable saddle than with whatever weight you would have to add to get a saddle that makes sense. When you get to e-bikes, those are real numbers now. You're talking 20 to 25 pounds. That's a big deal. So the second thing is, you've got a problem with sharing bike trails with motorcycles. I think even 18 miles an hour for an e-bike is too fast for a bike trail. It's too fast to guarantee someone who doesn't have to work, who doesn't have handling skills, who doesn't have anything else to ride on a bike path. If you're a really skilled bike rider, yeah, 18 miles an hour is not unreasonable to deal with the threats that are out there. Animals that decide that they want to use it as a crosswalk, groups of people who are walking, families with kids that can dart out at a moment's notice. And so I think the idea that you can have that a 28 mile per hour or 30 mile per hour vehicle can be on this type of a facility is going to create real dangers.
It looks like they're going to need to be regulated in some way anyway.
They're going to have to be regulated for 1,001 reasons.
Exactly.
And the safety of the batteries is the tip of the iceberg. Although it's a rather fiery tip.
It's an on fire tip.
It's a tip in flames.
Right, bursting into flames.
As long as we're talking about e-bikes, I do want to bring up another topic for people who want to be do-it-yourself motors, DIY motors. And that is the distinction between electric bikes and electrification of cycling and electronification of cycling.
Okay, that's too many terms.
So electrification is adding a motor to a bike, an electric motor to a bike. Electronification is providing electronic support for everything but the motor.
Oh, like shifting.
Like shifting, like batteries and your telephone, your mapping system, signaling, lights, horns, video cameras, any number of things that are now increasingly part of riding, especially in an urban area. Like, for example, brake lights. Imagine what would happen if you're riding in a Peloton and you start seeing brake lights ahead. You don't have to scream slow down. You see brake lights. We're used to that with cars.
We are.
If you're riding in a group, we're not used to that with bikes. We have to have someone going, slowing, and, oh, turning left. How about a turn signal? So I think somewhere, even if a bike isn't electrified, providing electric power support for cycling, signaling, and everything else is going to come in handy. Another area that will require some sort of power systems, and we're now starting to see products emerge that can keep bicycle tires pumped up. One of the big problems that has never gone away in our business is the flat tire, the underinflated tire, and ultimately the flat tire. And that is probably one of the biggest obstacles to people riding bikes. You're going, well, it's not a problem for me. I just go and check my tire every day. Imagine if you had to check your car tire every day in order to drive your car. What would that do to driving a car? And the answer is there has to be a way to keep tires properly inflated. The miniaturization of all sorts of products is going to open the door for that. So I kind of think that I can imagine a rim that has the ability, the reservoir and other things, to regulate tire pressure. And it may be that it also allows you to customize tire pressure so that you are able to adjust your tires for the terrain, any number of things like that. So I anticipate that manufacturers would do well, and some people like Envy have already been thinking about it with their support of dynamo hubs in their forks. But dynamo hubs supplying regular power so you're not screwing around with batteries is huge. I love SRAM wireless system, but I don't love having to pay attention to the batteries. But even if I had the Shimano system, I'd still have to pay attention to batteries.
Right.
You know, if the electronification of car or of the bicycle, even if you're not providing motor power, would actually be a great step in the evolution of cycling and integrating it into our everyday lives.
I like it. And, you know, I see Brian putting sun hubs on a lot of bikes and running that system through the fork and charging whatever it is we're charging too. You've got the sine wave thing that'll charge your phone. Yeah, there are all kinds of electronics that are available, but not ubiquitous yet. They're not on everybody, and they should be.
They're not systematized.
Right.
But, you know, and I would include things like brake lights, signaling, and things like that. There are just too many damn bikes on the road, and we want to have too many more bikes not to have this infrastructure in place. Now, the good news about electric bikes is that they're starting to have that infrastructure. But manufacturers ought to be thinking about that for bikes where we're the motor.
Good point. We're talking OEM now, that you can just go in and buy a bike. There's a topic we didn't cover that I don't, and I get different readings on this, whether or not the entry level or the cost of entry into cycling is too high for for a lot of people. Now, you and I have always been at this higher end of custom bikes. And you're talking about electronification of a lower end bike as well as maybe high end bikes. But do you think that we're going to get the number of people on bikes that we want to when the entry level is at this point fairly high?
Well, Europe provides a pretty good model for that. They have cheap bikes that have lights that are designed to be durable. So the answer is, if people want it, there's a way for people to get in. The more infrastructure that's out there, the more compelling it will be to do this. One of the things about COVID and the COVID boom that I find really exciting is that people bought bikes desperately in 2020 to be able to at least get out of their houses. We hadn't seen anything like this since the oil crisis.
Right.
1970s. We're literally 50 years later. Well, here's what happened in the 70s. People got their bikes and they took them out for a ride and they went around the block and they said, hey, this is pretty nice. Then they tried to go somewhere useful and they go, my life isn't.
That's true.
Then they had a flat tire and they didn't want to have to box the bike up and go to a bike shop to fix a flat tire. Then they discovered that they couldn't ride at night without endangering themselves. There was no infrastructure to go anywhere. It created a bust, and the bust was mitigated in the 80s by the mountain bikes, but it was still, the ridership was slow. However, enough people started getting involved in building up cycling infrastructure that over 50 years, the world is completely different.
It is different.
There's a rare city that doesn't have cycling infrastructure. Even though I would say Atlantis is probably 20 years behind the times, but they do have a system of bike trails. It's not complete enough. Places like Chicago went from being one of the worst places to cycle to being a wonderful place to cycle all throughout the city. And people are now discovering this. And I think that a lot of the people who got into cycling on an emergency basis, a lot more of them are going to continue to ride, and they will eventually upgrade their bikes. So I hold out hope. An $800 or $1,000 bike, considering if you're actually going to use it, is not a huge investment.
No, it's not.
You can't even compare it to a car. If you are talking about an electric bike that can go 15 miles an hour on bike trails with signals and other things in the $2,000 to $3,000 area, and you are in an area that has even reasonable weather, this is such a dramatic change from buying a car.
Yeah, and supporting a car ongoingly.
Supporting a car on an ongoing basis.
Right.
So I don't think e-bikes are going to go away. They need to evolve, but, you know, so it is going to be a different world, and it is going to continue to provide pressure to improve cycling infrastructure. So we're in a pretty virtuous cycle right now, and I'm certainly looking forward to it continuing.
Well, on that positive note, I want to remind you that you're always welcome here. That is always a pleasure to talk with you, and you always have such interesting things to say and think about. And I know you won't stop thinking about bicycling on some level ever. So I'm glad for that. It's never going to be far from your brain.
Well, I know how to hold a grudge too.
You got to let that stuff go. Richard Schwinn, what a wonderful conversation. Thank you so much. And we will talk again. Hello to everybody in the Schwinn family, Tucker, Anna, Shu, you, and thank you.
All right. Well, it's been a pleasure. It's always a pleasure. Take care. We'll see you later, Diane.
My thanks to Richard for taking time to talk with me today. I think the bicycle world is a poorer place without him and Waterford Precision Cycles, and I think his place is cemented in the history of our sport. Let's take a short break, and when we return, we'll speak with Sergio Bravo about the MBBS, the Master Bike Builders Show. You're listening to The Outspoken Cyclist. We are back on The Outspoken Cyclist. I'm Diane Jenks. With the absence of shows such as NABS and the New England Bike Builders Show, some regional options are beginning to fill the void, and today we're speaking with Sergio Bravo, who decided that it might just be time for a new Bike Builders Show. The Master Bike Builders Show will take place September 16th and 17th in Bentonville, Arkansas, and Sergio will tell us all about it. Hi, Sergio. Welcome to The Outspoken Cyclist. Thanks for being my guest today. How are you?
Very good. Thank you. How are you?
I'm great. Thanks for asking. So we're going to talk about a new show, Master Bike Builder Show in Bentonville, which of course is the new destination for all kinds of great cycling. But there's been an absence of great handmade shows since NABS sort of went away and the pandemic, and there's a big hole. And I think that it's a good idea to begin to try and fill it with some of these craftsmen kind of builders. So tell me about the show. Tell me where it is, what it is, when it is, all of that.
Yeah, sure. Thanks for having me, by the way. I really appreciate the opportunity to share more about what I'm doing with this show. Yeah, as you mentioned, NABS went away a few years ago. And almost right away, I had a couple people come to me and say, you know, you should do something. They already knew that I was producing the Cycle of Influence Summit and that I was doing that in Bentonville. And so those two things combined led some people to just kind of, you know, let me know that maybe I could do something. And I thought it over and I thought, yeah, I can. And this is a really interesting community and one that is underserved as a whole, and even more so that NABS is gone. So I began the process of basically putting together the show, the Master Bike Builder Show. It's in Bentonville, Arkansas, and it takes place September 16th and 17th, which is a little over a month away. We have an outdoor venue. Bentonville has really good weather, so in mid-September, it's going to probably be beautiful. What most significantly about that venue is that it is directly across the street from probably the main trailhead in Bentonville, which is the All-American Trail that leads to a slaughter pen and then basically spreads out into many, many other trail systems. So a lot of people start their rides there. Also directly parallel to that dirt trail is a paved trail for pedestrians and kind of low-level bicycle riding, which people use to visit the Compton Gardens Museum, which is right there as well, the very large, beautiful art museum. So I anticipate that's one of the things I really wanted for these builders is to produce a good amount of traffic through the venue and do it in a way that we would have the capability to also draw in traffic from other areas other than just the trailhead. I should mention too that, you know, we're only about two blocks away from the central part of downtown Bentonville, which is the town square, where all the restaurants, coffee shops, bike shops are.
Let me ask you a couple of questions about exhibitors. Are you only going to have builders, or are you also going to have people like suppliers, like tubing people or lug people, or even people like component manufacturers, or is it just a builder show?
No, I have been talking to some what we're calling suppliers, and I'm hoping to sign on some suppliers here in the next week or two. So yeah, there will be some suppliers, although the main emphasis is definitely on the builders. And so that's my focus. And I've been doing outreach on my own to get those builders and reaching out to many of them. I'd like to mention too that I've had a really good amount of interest, more so than I ever thought I would, for the show. A lot of that interest is for next year, unfortunately, but that's kind of, you know, we kind of started a little, just maybe just a little bit late. I've had interest from Canada, Alberta, BC. I've had interest from Europe as well, even Australia. So I'm really excited about those things for next year. For this year, we already have a few builders from local builders, which I'm excited about because they have this opportunity, near home, for them to display their wares. But also we have a few builders in Colorado, and we have other ones that are planning to attend from Texas and California, I think. So we're still working on getting the space filled, and it's going to be a smaller show for sure. But I feel that that's going to give the exhibitors that are there a good opportunity to have quality time with this very passionate Bentonville bicycling community.
Yeah, let me take a moment to reintroduce you, and then I want to talk a little bit about Bentonville and how it has sort of become this bicycle mecca, and how these shows kind of grow organically. We're speaking with Sergio Bravo. He is the producer of the Master Bike Builder Show. There is also prior to that, the days before, a couple of days, something, a summit called the Cycle of Influence Summit, which is more, if I am not mistaken, industry focused than consumer focused.
Yes. Last year, we put on the first year of the Cycle of Influence Summit. It is intended to be an industry summit for people interested in the industry, the bicycling industry and the outdoor industry. And the summit is basically a conference style. One of the things that's unique about that event is that all the topics are really relevant topics of the day for the cycling industry. What's happening? What are the problems? So on e-bike, diversity, things like that. Each topic has about three to four panelists on it of varying experiences and different experiences that they bring to that topic. And I do that because I want to create the best and most interesting conversation. It would be useless to have, you know, everybody with the same experiences in the industry. Then they're just kind of talking to each other, and they're not creating any new conversations. The summit takes place on Wednesday and Thursday of that week. That's the 13th and the 14th of September. And then the Master Bike Builder Show is that weekend, the 16th and 17th, Saturday and Sunday.
Well, that would be really cool for people to possibly go from one to the other. And when we're talking about industry people, I am also assuming, rightly or wrongly, that you're talking about advocacy too, because advocacy sort of tumbles over from, you know, what industry does to what communities do. And so, you know, it's nice to know that Bentonville, which has turned into this amazing cycling community, is offering this. In fact, I have spoken with people from Bentonville in the past, and it's just become this I'm surprised. I'm not sure what it is about it, but someday I'll get down there and take a look. So let's talk a little more about the Master Bike Builders Show. You're still looking for exhibitors to sign up. What's interesting is it's really not very expensive. So shows such as NABS, which of course is gone, unfortunately, the Philly Bike Expo, which is a wonderful show, but it's in a convention center, so it's quite expensive. This is a pretty reasonable place, other than the fact that you need to travel to Bentonville if you're from outside the area, to exhibit your wares. I'm wondering where exhibitors, potential exhibitors, can find out more. And I know you're offering a really cool discount for exhibitors right now. And we're not going to talk about what that is because I'm not supposed to say that on the air, but it'll be on our website. And so will the links. And so will all the other stuff. But who do you want to attract? Who do you think will be able to come in? And how expensive is it to travel to Bentonville?
Well, that depends on where you're coming from, of course.
Yeah.
And how lavishly you want to live while you're in Bentonville. So Bentonville is a great community. It's a small little town. You know, the first time I went there, I was actually shocked of what I found there, because it does have that small little town feel, but there is very upscale and beautiful and, you know, modern businesses and buildings, and they're continuing to do that. And I would mention that museum before. It's the Crystal Bridges Museum in Bentonville, which is it's beautiful. I've been in art my whole life, and so it's one of the better museums I've ever been to. The architect is great. You know, you can go there. There's like high-end upscale coffee shops that you would find like in New York, and great food. The food has gotten really good. They bring in top chefs from all over the country. So it's definitely a rising community, but they are keeping very small town feel so far. And that's what's really interesting about what they're doing.
Well, we have the Walton family down there, and I know the grandsons have been very active in cycling and have put a lot of time, effort, and their money where their mouths are. So I really appreciate that. I have customers and friends who have been to Bentonville and said it is just a phenomenal place to ride. So I'm wondering if people are coming to the show and also want to ride, are there going to be events that they can do? Or are you just going to send them out on map with maps? Are there maps? What's available in that regard?
Yeah, I mean, Bentonville is really easy to ride around in. They have a great trail system that's pretty easy to follow. And so that part of it's very easy. Yeah, there are some apps from local providers are, again, really easy. And of course, all the big apps, Strava and Trail Force, and those all have Bentonville trails on them as well. Our plan here with the Master Bike Builder Sale, as I mentioned before, we have the Cycle of Influence Summit Wednesday and Thursday, which ends Thursday night. And then on Friday morning, we're planning a breakfast for people who have stayed over from the summit and from the builders still who are arriving. So we're planning a breakfast that morning and then a ride, a group ride. So that'll be fun. And then also Friday night, we will have a reception for the bike builders exhibitors. Another cool thing that I have planned for the Master Bike Builder Show is that we're gonna do a podcast there. And that's going to be moderated by Zapata Espinoza, who a lot of people might know or should know. He's been in the cycling industry for many, many years and is a well-respected journalist and has been around the world and all the races. I don't think I have to say, explain to people who he is, but it's going to be really exciting for him to be able to talk to some of these exhibitors. So the plan is for him to interview the exhibitors that are there. We will post those up later on YouTube and also on the podcast.
Yeah, he's a cool guy. I spoke with him not too long ago, and he's so well versed in our world. Let's end this with how builders can find out more and how potential attendees can find out more. Where are they going to get all the information?
Yeah, I think that you list all the websites and information afterwards, but I'll mention them right now as well. And so the Master Bike Builder Show, of course, has a website, www.masterbikebuildershow.com. It's pretty easy, the name of the show. The Instagram page is Master Bicycle Builders. And the reason for that is because there's a lot of motorcycle bike builders, and we didn't want to confuse that audience.
And you have a newsletter.
Yeah, we have a newsletter. Go to the website, sign up for it. There's a lot of information on the newsletter, and we are promoting a discount, as we mentioned before. Our rates are already incredibly reasonable, but we want to get builders there. The whole goal for me really this year is to get builders there, get them to Bentonville, let them see who the community is, let them be engaged with that community. I wanted to mention too that we're creating a pretty strong marketing effort there in the community to draw as many people to the show as possible. We're doing a nice poster that we're gonna give out to shops and coffee shops, restaurants, anybody will put it up. We're also connected with NWAC, which is the Northwestern Arkansas Community College. And they have a very strong bicycle service technician program. So they have a lot of interest there. University of Arkansas also has a entrepreneurial program of which they're going to be involved in some way as well. And of course, they'll be promoting to their students, which is nearby in Fayetteville. There's a huge University of Arkansas football game that weekend, which apparently a lot of people attend, come in from out of town, so we have that audience. There's the Women of Oz Summit that weekend, which we have some collaboration with in terms of sharing codes and deals for either or events. So I would invite any people who are attending any of those events just come by and visit the Master Bicycle Show.
That's all really cool that you have all those things going on at the same time, and you'll get a lot of eyeballs and maybe people just walking through who don't know about custom bikes, by the way. You know, it's a very tiny niche, and once they learn, maybe, I mean, we're looking with the demise of people like Waterford and Cerrada, and now we've got NABS is gone, and the New England Bike Builders Show, which was going to happen this year, has been postponed. This is an opportunity to get some eyes on some custom builders, and I really appreciate that, being in that part of the industry. So
one thing I wanted to mention, I don't think we discussed it, but one thing I wanted to mention is just the cycling community in Bentonville and how passionate and how broad they are. And so exhibitors, who people who sign up to exhibit at the Master Bike Builder Show, can expect a community that is very broad in their cycling flavor, if you will. You have families with cargo bikes, you have kids bikes, you have jump style bikes, of course you have mountain bikes, you have gravel bikes, it's a huge gravel bike community. You still have road bikes. One exhibitor asked me about track bikes, you know, I'm pretty sure that somebody there is going to do doing track rides. So that's one of the beauty, I think, of exhibiting and attending the Master Bike Builder Show, is that the community there is very broad, and they love all styles of cycling, not just one type or style.
Well, Sergio, I appreciate you taking time to talk with me today. We've been speaking with Sergio Bravo. He is the producer and director of the Master Bike Builders Show. We will have everything on outspokencyclist.com. Builders, listen up. Maybe this is the opportunity you've been waiting for to get out in front of the public again, post-pandemic, post-NABS. And I appreciate you putting on the show and putting your effort behind it. I know we spoke last year, and I'm glad to see it growing this year. I've already looked at the exhibitor list and it is growing. So I hope you have a lot of luck. I probably will not get to Bentonville this year, but maybe next year. And I would like to do that. Thanks so much and have a great show.
Great. Thank you, Diane. Thank you so much.
You're welcome. My thanks to Sergio for sharing all the information about the Master Bike Builders Show. You can find out more on the show's website and sign up for their newsletter, or log on to outspokencyclist.com, where we will list all the pertinent information for you. I hope you enjoyed our show today. You can find show notes, links, and photos at outspokencyclist.com. Follow us on social media, including Facebook and Instagram. And subscribe to our podcast on your favorite app so you never miss an episode. Thank you so much for listening. Please stay safe, stay well, and remember, there is always time for a ride. Bye-bye.
Thanks for joining us today on The Outspoken Cyclist with Diane Jenks. We welcome your thoughts and contributions on our Facebook page, or visit outspokencyclist.com to leave a comment on any episode. We will be back next week with new guests, topics, conversations, and news from the world of cycling. Subscribe to the show on your favorite podcast app and you'll never miss an episode. The Outspoken Cyclist is a copyrighted production of DBL Promotions with the assistance of WJCU-FM Cleveland, a service of John Carroll University. Thanks again for listening, ride safely, and we'll see you next week.